You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artist by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking, on with the podcast. Welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Colin, and with me are my comrades and co-hosts, Tracy.
Hello.
And Ian.
Hello.
Each episode we take...
Why did you laugh when you said my name?
It was because Tracy went, hello.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I thought I got something on my face.
No.
You laugh at my greeting every episode.
It was
I'm
like...
I'm starting to get a complex.
You sounded like you're progressively getting further away from the microphone, saying, hello. So each episode we'll be taking a letter from the alphabet and talking about two bands, one well known, one not as well known. This episode is the letter N.
For Necro Deathmort.
Yes, that is the correct letter, but that's not the band we're talking about. We shall be talking about...
Fields of the Nephilim.
Neils of the Phephilim. So, the letter N, we'll be talking about Joanna Newsom and Nine Inch Nails. So, Tracy, do you want to tell us about Joanna Newsom?
Newsom is an American folk singer-songwriter from California. She was trained in piano and harp from a very young age. Most of her songs are characterized by her wonderful harp playing, but piano and harpsichord feature on many songs too. Before her first album was released, she'd got a couple of EPs that she'd put onto a CD. And someone passed a copy of that to Bonnie Prince Billy, Will Oldham.
Will Oldham.
And he loved it, asked her to tour with him. And he also passed the CD on to Drag City.
Yeah.
To Drag Records, who signed her up.
Which was his label at the time.
And she's been with them ever since. So she's released four albums on that label. There was the Milk-Eyed Mender in 2004, Is in 2006.
Ease.
It is pronounced Is.
It's is.
How is it spelled?
It's spelled Y-S.
But it's pronounced is.
Is.
Yeah, that's how I'd pronounce it.
Have One On Me in 2010 and Divers in 2015. Now, the thing about Joanna Newsom is she's Marmite. Mm-hmm. I personally adore her voice. But for a lot of people, they can't get past it.
My dad's comment in the car last night was, how old is she? She sounds like an 8-year-old stroppy little girl.
And you know what? It really annoys her when people say that her voice is childlike. Yeah. She hates it.
Admittedly,
fucking shit. You sound like a child, right? Just deal with
that. That was on that particular track was one off
the first album, though.
Like, I mean,
she's matured and later on.
That sounded like a really harsh comment.
Well, you say,
but it's, she's got a great
voice.
Matured.
Say she's matured. Actually, the difference in her voice from the first two albums to the next two is actually because in 2009, she suffered from vocal nodules.
Yeah.
She couldn't speak nor sing for about 2 months, and it completely changed the tone of her voice. So she's still got little elements.
For the better.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I love the first album. I love her voice on that. It just, it really appeals to me. But I appreciate that some people can't get past that.
I feel like you were both expecting me to hate her, but I really
didn't. We were.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't, because I know you heard a song a while back. We played one before one of the earlier podcasts, and I know you quite liked it then.
Yeah, well, she reminds me of Julie Christmas, who's one of my favourite vocalists.
She's also got a sort of childlike kind of voice.
I was talking with Zach yesterday, in fact. He really fucking hates Julie Christmas.
Why?
Or is it his wife that really fucking hates Julie Christmas?
Probably his wife.
Maybe.
Because, yeah,
we were talking about it yesterday.
Mariner album.
Yeah, the Cult Luna one that we talked about.
Because I was with him yesterday at Ride to the Wall. And.
But, yeah, I love her.
He's talking about her at Bloodstock.
She's fucking great. Apparently, she's really nice as well.
Okay. Cool. But yeah, like you were saying about the sort of divisiveness of what people's opinions are on her voice, I've seen her described as sounding like a cartoon character.
Yes.
And like a duck.
One track.
Singing hamster is one someone said to me.
This probably isn't selling it to people that haven't listened to her at all.
I'm
going
to have to find the playlist so I can tell you which track it was, because they're all stupid song titles.
They're beautiful. It's one of the other things that's so utterly charming and enchanting about her.
This beautiful song title, Monkey and Bear.
Oh.
Yeah. Right? It's a silly song title, I'm not going to lie. But the instrumentation and the vocal harmonies and stuff, it sounds like a cartoon. Like a musical cartoon.
Like an old sort of Merry Melodies sort of thing from the 30s.
When I put it on, I was like, the fuck?
I mean, so Monkey and Bear is from her second album, and on that one she collaborated with Van Dyke Parks. It was actually the recommendation.
Is he?
He worked on
Beach Boys.
He worked Beach Boys. Smile.
Pet Sounds and Smile.
Yeah.
Yes, he was the lyricist, wasn't he?
He did the lyricist,
yes.
And he was also, I think he did string arrangement.
He's worked with Nielsen, Rykuda.
He's also put out albums in his own right. There's an album called Song Cycle, which I've not heard, but it is like lauded as a classic.
The suggestion for her to work with him was actually from Bill Callahan from Smog, who was her then boyfriend.
Yes,
but she worked with him on that, and so the album became lush string and arrangements. It's a pastoral album. Don't grimace like that when I describe it as a pastoral.
I was just mentally ticking off my Tracy Bingo cards. That's all right.
Yep.
and Monkey and Bear, I mean, it's this epic tale of a monkey and bear escaping from a life of servitude in the circus. Now, Joanna doesn't really expand very much on her lyrics and what they're about, but she doesn't like them to be taken too literally, so it isn't really about a monkey and a bear. But, I mean, I think it's...
To be honest, a lot of the time you need a, like, degree in literature to be able to
understand
a lot of her lyrics anyway.
That one, it's a beautiful allegory of...
Allegory?
Allegory. I'm catching Colin's problem.
Story.
Colin Enunciation.
It's about power and exploitation.
Yeah. Yeah, because the monkey is exploiting the bear.
Let's get out of here. Let's get free from our shackles from this circus. And then he becomes the captor.
Well, that's probably the one song that I actually have an interpretation on the lyrics of what it's about. And it reminds me of Animal Farm. Because it's basically they're getting away from the humans because they've got this life of servitude, and they run away, and then the monkey is basically like the pigs in Animal Farm, where it's four legs good, two legs bad.
It's such a wonderful album, though. The more I listen to it, the more I hear, actually. Little details reveal themselves with each listen.
Yeah.
I mean, I was listening last night to Cosmia, and sometime around 3.5 minutes in, there was a tiny phrase on an accordion that I'd not noticed before. Yeah. And it's about a dozen notes on accordion, and then it's gone, and there's no more accordion in the rest of the song.
Yeah, and you are an accordion aficionado, so...
I will always pick up... Well, I say I always will. It's taken me how many years? I mean, that was in 20... So that's 10 years, and I'd never noticed the accordion on that.
10 years old now, that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I know.
I got into Joanna Newsom when the first album came out, because Sprout and the Bean, which is off Milk Eyed Mender, was on a free CD with The Enemy. And it was, I think it got like Devendra Banhart on there as well.
She toured with him after Milk Eyed Mender.
It was part of the sort of freak folk, sort of anti-folk kind of scene. And the first album, she's a virtuoso musician. She's absolutely meticulous the way she's playing. But the way it's recorded is a little bit ramshackle, and there's bits where the vocals that are on Sprout and the Bean, there's a bit where she's singing in harmony with herself, and
it's all double tracked and treble tracked.
I think there's about four vocals on there, all layered, and it's the gain's slightly too high, so it's clipping.
But I like that.
The ramshackle production reminded me, and also a lot of her vocal melody choices reminded me of Vic Chestnut.
Yeah,
the album. Yeah.
Because that was recorded by Michael Stipe, and it's very lo-fi.
Yeah.
And it's got the same kind of vibe to it, I think.
Yeah. But then later albums, the next one is...
Was recorded by Steve Albini.
And whereas a lot of his production is really, really sort of harsh, that's probably his lushest sounding... sort of production.
But then, I mean, he goes in, he sets up some amps and some mics.
Yeah.
Also,
and then
he
leaves them
album,
to it.
So, no.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
he did at least two mono albums.
But then the next two have got progressively... I mean, Have One On Me is very, very sort of lush production. It's a triple album. So it's great, but it's too long.
It is too long.
I
have never listened to it all the way through in one sitting. And actually, I don't recognise half the tracks on the third CD. I just never seem to get that far.
I have listened to it all in one go a couple of times on like very long car journeys and stuff like that. But yeah, then the next album, she went back to it being a single disc, which...
Have One On Me, it goes a bit prog, really, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely prog tendencies, which is great. I like prog.
Yeah.
It's like prog baroque.
Yeah, well, there's jazz elements in there. I mean, what it reminds me of... I mean, the obvious comparisons are people like Kate Bush and Tori Amos, who I've always liked that kind of... I hate the word kooky, but it's what always gets used to describe that kind of singer-songwriter.
Better way, because mostly wankers describe themselves
exactly
as kooky.
Yeah, that, well... Kate Bush has probably never used the word kooky to describe herself.
No, I don't
Tori
even
Amos
want to
hasn't.
Imagine what Kate Bush describes herself as.
Regina Spektor, Joanna Newsom, none of them would use the word kooky. It's bell-end journalists would use it. But it does seem to sort of describe, to fit it into a category.
It kind of does.
I prefer quirky.
Quirky, that's a better word. We will
but
go with
also
that.
Still only wankers describe themselves as quirky.
Possibly.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a bit quirky. Fuck off, you're a bell-end.
Do you know what? There was something
quirky... as a person descriptive means dull as fuck actually.
Yeah.
Something I found on her wiki page actually made me laugh. She said her early work was strongly influenced by polyrhythms. So multiple rhythms played against each other. Mm. And
it takes a lot of influence from African music.
Yeah.
There's an instrument that's very similar to a harp called a kora, which is a bit like
a harp.
Harp. Bit like a harp, it's a kora. Yeah, similar to a harp is a kora.
I see where you went. I see that, how
it's
that happened.
I was trying to remember the name of the African instrument.
Yeah.
and there's a kora player called... Now, I'm almost certainly going to pronounce this wrong, but you two don't
Go
know
for
how
it.
It's pronounced. So, as far as we're all concerned, Timuni Diabate.
Oh, Timuni Diabate.
Yes, yes, him. He is a kora player, and I believe she's quite heavily influenced by him. Because polyrhythms, for anybody that doesn't know, it's where you've got two different time signatures playing against itself.
Yeah.
So you've got,
as
like,
I just said about 30 seconds ago.
Yeah,
but yeah, like mathematically, you've got like.
But you didn't explain it.
Three bars of 4/4.
I said
four,
two
over,
rhythms played.
Okay. Oh, God, is it 3 bars of 4/4 over 4 bars of 3/4? Does that? That works, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. It normally resolves
and then
itself
as it,
later
and then as
on,
it comes
yeah.
round, you get the emphasis in a different yeah. bar each yeah. time. And yeah, and it will eventually resolve itself yeah. back it, after it, so many bars, mm. yeah.
It's not just in her early work, because on Divers, there's... what's the name of that track? The one that's got electric guitar in it, which is really unusual.
Leaving the City.
Leaving the City. That's the... she's singing in 3/4 while playing over a 4/4.
Yeah.
Rhythm.
But anyway, but after Is, though, she lost interest in polyrhythms and she said they stopped being fascinating to me and started feeling wanky. you can get a little too technical yeah. with these things sometimes.
I think that's, yeah, I think Is, I don't think there's many on Have One On Me, but she definitely came back to it for Divers. But I think Have One On Me reminds me more of sort of, there's a lot of, like the jazz influence of people like jazzy sort of singer-songwriters like Joni Mitchell, who I really, really can't get into. But on Have One On Me, she reminds me of a Joni Mitchell that I don't hate because she hasn't done that fucking stupid voice at the end of Big Yellow Taxi.
I mean, she kind of goes sort of kind of like blues gospel folk.
Yeah.
On Have One On Me. And there's even more instruments. I mean, there's brass sections. There's something that sounds like a zither in there.
Definitely zithers on.
And the harmonies on there, it isn't just her harmonising with herself. She's actually got a couple of other singers
she's,
on there.
Her sister Emily harmonises with her.
Oh, really?
Of course, she's been in a lot of band.
Because, of course, Emily, the track from Is,
yeah.
is about her sister. And she's an astro scientist.
Astro scientist.
Astrophysicist?
Astrophysicist.
No, she's
lady.
A
astrologer.
No, she's one
astronomer.
She's an astro scientist.
Astronaut. Australopithecus.
She's an ostrich.
Come on. Find the fucking word, Tracy.
I'm reading my fucking notes.
Well, you should have learned. What are you looking for that? I've seen her live twice and they were both very, very different gigs.
What does she look like? Because I...
An elf.
Ah, yes, I thought.
A very, 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 very beautiful
she's
elf.
She's very beautiful.
I thought she would probably be quite elven.
She looks like she sounds.
She's tiny.
Her image definitely, definitely fits the music.
That's good, because I hate it when people sound like one thing and like, how confused were you the first time you saw the singer from Coheed and Cambria? Right? He sounds like Robert Plant.
But he looks like a he those looks like 90s a, trolls dolls.
No, Care Bear Bunch. Because his hair's out past yeah. his chubby dude. And then he sounds like Robert Plant.
Yeah.
That was not my Robert Plant voice, because
no,
I can't do one
it
of those.
Not.
But look, I like it yeah. to look like it sounds, really.
But yeah, I saw her, first time I saw her was at Latitude Festival.
The most middle class of festivals.
The absolutely most middle class of festivals, where they've actually started doing a slot on the festival that was invented for her. Like, whereas at Glastonbury you've got the Legends slot, they have the Joanna Newsom slot, which was basically,
yeah.
they wanted her to headline.
Yeah.
And... she couldn't make it on either of the nights in the evening. She was playing a gig in London in the evening on one of them, so they helicoptered her
yeah.
helicoptered her in to play opening the main stage at 11 in the morning.
Oh, is that what they call the Joanna Newsom slot?
Yes.
Oh no, that's not what I thought.
So the following year Tom York did it,
right? I thought maybe that a slot had become known as the Joanna Newsom slot, because wasn't she one of the artists who insisted on, when she was playing, that no other acts played at the same time?
No, it wasn't her insisting that. It was a scheduling thing.
Oh, really?
She didn't insist that. It was...
The audience certainly interpreted it as that, and it's like, what?
No,
so I don't like Joanna Newsom, but I've got to fucking listen to her anyway.
No, it's absolute bullshit. Those people did not know anything
also,
about the festival.
There's
at all.
Lots of other things going on at festivals. Just go buy
there is.
Incredibly overpriced coffee or like.
Yes, yeah, Latitude.
Get your face painted or something.
Exactly. Latitude.
Go look at the pink sheep.
But at Latitude, there's not that many bands that play on the main stage anyway.
No.
They have like six acts on in a day.
But anyway.
But yeah, so she played at 11 o'clock in the morning, which in California time was like the middle of the night.
Okay.
Like, well, no, it was way, I think it was like 3 or 4 in the morning or something.
Is there relevance to that?
Well, yeah, because she was completely tired.
Ah.
And she, it was a solo set, and she was really endearingly forgetting words all over the place, with people in the front line, front row, reminding her what
the words
were.
Feeding her the lines.
And stuff like that. But then the next time I saw her, me and Tracy saw her at the Symphony Hall in Birmingham, where she got a full band.
Yeah.
And it was really, really slick production, and there wasn't a note out of place. And she got Roy Harper, 70s folk legend, supporting her. And he was supplying the ramshackle forgetting all the words. Because he was one of the most shambolic performers I've ever seen.
But it was brilliant anyhow.
It was.
But she absolutely loved that venue, because the thing about playing a harp is it's not like a guitar that you can retune in between songs, because it's got God knows how many strings and it's fucking massive. And she said that the setup of the Symphony Hall and the humidity levels in there meant that her harp didn't go out of tune halfway through the gig. It's, which is usually a problem.
Weird that a symphony hall would be designed to be friendly to classical
instruments. I know.
Well, I know, right?
Thoroughly bizarre. But another thing that's good about the symphony hall that I don't know if she mentioned, but the acoustics in there are so good.
Again, who'd have thought it? Exactly. That a venue is designed.
It's to demonstrate how good it was. The first person I ever saw play there was Neil Finn from Crowded House.
Yeah.
Went to a solo gig that he did there in late 90s, I think it was. And at one point he got them to turn off the PA. So they completely turned everything off. You heard him click as it turned off. And then he just walked out into the middle of the stage just with an acoustic guitar, completely unamplified, and played a song. And we were sitting right at the back. And you could hear it absolutely perfectly.
My mum went to a concert at the Symphony Hall about a week ago. And this artist did the same thing. But you're not going to be as impressed.
No.
It was Neil Sedaka.
No, he's not as good. He's
but
not
he
as
also,
good as Neil.
But he also did one without the PA to demonstrate amazing acoustics of that venue.
You would if you were playing there.
You would, absolutely.
I've only seen one act at Symphony Hall and he did not.
Who was that?
Joe Satriani.
See, if Joe Satriani turned all his amps off, you definitely wouldn't hear it, because he doesn't really play acoustic much.
I think, another band we saw there actually didn't... it wasn't so much about the acoustics that suited the band. It was the only stage that you could fit all the fucking members on.
Was that Bell and Sebastian?
Bell and Sebastian.
So it's not just two people then?
No, there's a lot of people in Bell and Sebastian. We'll get to that in another series, maybe.
Maybe.
I'm sure they're on Tracy's list.
I'm going to hate them.
I think you could be right.
I think it'd be safe to say.
Shall we go back to Joanna Newsom for a bit?
Shall we?
Yes.
So where did you first hear her?
I think I heard her do a session from the Milk-Eyed Mender, and they played, I can't remember, they played one of the very quirky harpsichord ones, maybe Peach Plum Pear, and they definitely played This Side of the Blue, which actually stands alone on that album, I think, as being very different to any of the other tracks. And I was just captivated immediately by her voice. Just...
Yeah, it's if you are one of the people that like it, you really tend to like
it. It's just, and it's immediate.
And it's I
can imagine, the first time I heard her sing, I was like, yeah, I can see why Tracy thought this was going to get on my tits. It does not, but I can see why this is the
most
marmite voice
I've
heard.
I'm so pleased, and now I'm feeling bad that I'm not going to like one of your later choices.
It's all right.
But we'll get to that in another episode.
But that was very cryptic.
It was, wasn't it?
There's probably quite a few of them that you won't like and a few of mine. But anyway,
probably.
That's what makes it more fun.
Yes.
It'd be boring if we liked every band, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But going on back to the horrible Q word of quirky, things like, particularly, I think what gave her a reputation for that is some of her lyrics on earlier albums, where you've got there's a lyric in the Book of Right On, which says, "I killed my dinner with karate," which is an excellent lyric. I love that.
It's a pretty decent lyric, that is definitely.
She's also got a song called Swansea, and I'm sort of wondering if she's ever actually been to Swansea.
I guess.
Because I have, and it's
not worth
it. I didn't write a song about it. The only person that really needs to write a song about it is using the actual Welsh name of Swansea, which I'm definitely going to pronounce this wrong, but it's Abator. And I really think that Nick Cave needs to do a live gig there and release a live album called Abator Blues.
That would be cool. That would be cool.
Boom tish.
Yeah. I think that every time I drive to my nan's house because I go past Swansea on the way. Anything else?
Her harp playing.
It's good, isn't it? It's... Yeah, I like it. I want a harp.
It's an amazing instrument. I'd love to be able to play something like that. But
she's just... definitely in my top one harp players of all time.
100%.
Who would you have as second on the list?
You're right, I can't actually think of anyone else who plays a full harp. I mean, an auto harp. I know several people that play auto harp.
There is someone in the Polyphonic Spree, but I don't know.
Auto harp's a cop-out.
Well, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and PJ Harvey played her worst album using an auto harp.
Yeah. So. The drummer of A Place to Bury Strangers plays auto harp on one of the tracks.
Ah.
A really disturbing, wailing track. I loved it. They supported Black Angels the other week.
So
I was really annoyed by that because I'd never heard of Black Angels. And I was like, I don't really want to go to that gig then. I've never
heard
of
them. And then found out the support band.
Yeah, like literally the day of the gig when I'd got plans. I was like, motherfucker.
They were bloody good.
I bet they were.
So very, very noisy.
No, that was the first gig I got to the front of, looked at the pedals and was like, what? I don't know what any of these fucking things are. And some dude just rocked up next to me and went, you're confused, right? I'm like, mm-hmm. He builds his own. I'm like, oh, thanks. Death by Audio pedals.
Yes. Oh, of course. Yes, I did know that. I'd just forgotten.
So
cool. Should we go on to Nine Inch Nails then?
Yes, let us do that.
This Place to Bury Strangers is fairly good sort of segue
because they've toured together.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Right. So let's talk about Nine Inch Nails. You're keeping in step.
Okay, Nine Inch Nails. Again, we've got the Wikipedia thing here.
You need the Wikipedia page?
I'm going to be able to elucidate a little more. I've got this open for dates more than anything. So.
Do you know the name of the main person?
Yes.
Excellent.
I also know that Trent is not his first name.
It is Michael.
Exactly. So, Trent Reznor, Oscar-winning composer, because we can legitimately say that now, formed Nine Inch Nails in 1988. Formed seems like a bit of a misnomer, really, as
it's
other than
him.
A live entity, it's him.
Yeah.
Up until very recently.
When Atticus Ross became a full-time member.
Yes, his composing friend. From all of the soundtracks, what he has done.
That sounds like what Trent Reznor's parents would say. Is your composing friend coming for dinner?
My composing friend?
Composing friend.
Yeah, the first song I ever danced to was... Head Like a Hole.
Yeah.
So
we should probably explain that they're an industrial band.
They are an industrial band. Well, it's industrial electronic. They've definitely wandered more into electronic recently, I'd have said, but yeah, it's still industrial. They've had several albums. I should have just gone onto the discography instead of...
You should have, didn't you?
I wish we had some kind of sound which could signify...
Ian scrolling through some albums.
I
just can't believe that Ian's having to look up things to do with Nine Inch Nails.
I know, because I want to do it properly.
I know.
So we got, Pretty Hate Machine, Downward Spiral, The Fragile With Teeth, or With A Teeth.
With A Teeth,
as we have to pronounce it. Year Zero, it counts Ghosts 1 to 5.
Yeah, like, that's an album.
The Slip.
Why would it not be? Sorry.
It's an instrumental album.
I wondered if we're getting back to My Bloody Valentine, where it's like, well, who says what's an album and what's album and what's a...
I always thought of it more as a Reznor thing than a Nine Inch Nails thing. Because it is.
But as you've already established, Nine Inch Nails is Reznor.
But there is a difference. Like, his soundtrack work
is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
But he's definitely not Nine Inch Nails.
Which is okay. Nine Inch Nails. But going back to what you just said about mini albums, there was the Broken EP.
Yeah, I skipped that deliberately. The Broken EP.
And Fixed.
Fixed EP.
Which is a remix, is one of
the most recent, not the actual events, and Ad Violence EPs, which are both pretty damn good.
Yes.
He's become a lot more productive of late, because we had, like, from 1989 to 1994, like, two albums.
Two albums plus the Broken and Fixed EPs.
Then nothing can... The Fixed EP doesn't even count, though.
Doesn't, because he...
Then nothing for 5 years... Then nothing for 6 years. And then he was like, wait a second. You got Year Zero, Ghosts, and The Slip in this, like, a 2 year period.
Yeah.
Now he's putting out stuff pretty damn regularly. So,
but very surprisingly, because he was very quiet for a while.
I love, The Slip, he's just been like, so, you've got a new song now.
Yeah.
There, I've released a new song. Or, like, yeah, there's a new EP out now. You're like, what? Because he gave The Slip away.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it was free download.
Free download straight away. And so we did the same with the first quarter of Ghosts.
Yeah.
That was a immediate free download of this bit, but you can buy the rest of it in a ridiculously ultra deluxe vinyl
he
package.
Is changing the paradigm of record release.
Yeah.
I think, because, you know, you can now.
Yes, definitely.
Like, Radiohead have been doing the same kind of thing as well, haven't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, with, like, In Rainbows, where they did the pay what you want thing.
Mm.
And Trent's done similar sort of things.
And also, he just gives shit away as well.
Yeah.
Like, there's been torrents of stuff.
He basically put a... When Nine Inch Nails split up after... Was it after The Slip, or was there another one before that? And then before Hesitation Marks?
Yeah, The Slip.
Yeah. So basically he didn't want to put out a traditional best of album, so he made three compilations of torrents. So there was like a sort of hits type thing, there was like a deep cuts type thing, and there was like a quiet chilled out kind of thing, and he just put a compilation together and put them up on torrent sites as like a primer for new people to get into Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, I think he's got the right attitude to music. He's not too precious.
The DIY aesthetic.
Yeah, he
still has, to this point. His production's always phenomenal.
Yeah.
He's just a good dude. He's fucking talented. And he actually seems to really care about what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely.
Did he have a biography out around sort of 2004, 2005? Because I thought...
Not that I know of. Are you thinking of Marilyn Manson's?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
He features in that quite
ever.
A lot.
No, because, I mean, like all good English students, I worked at Waterstones for a time. and I thought there was a Trent Reznor biography out when I worked there that was really incredibly popular. And it was about him and his recovery and...
It's not a Reznor-sanctioned book, I don't think.
There's been various books out over the years, but nothing that's been particularly big and official or anything, as I would have had it, definitely.
Mm.
Same.
I don't know, maybe I've mixed up with someone else then.
Possibly.
But not Marilyn Manson.
No. So, anyway, you're about to let rip. Please tell us why you foolishly think Nine Inch Nails aren't very good.
Well, I never said that. I mean, the thing is, my description of them, I'd call them minor key, fuzzy industrial with overwrought rock vocals.
His vocals are...
That seems fair. They're still one of my favourites.
And it's not that I dislike it. I don't always get it. It doesn't get me emotional. I listen to Maudlin Folk and Alt Country Heartbreak.
So you're
as
telling
you know.
Me that Hurt hasn't made you emotional at all? Even I'll accept listening to the Johnny Cash version and going,
yes,
that's really emotional.
That's
Although if you think Johnny Cash wrote it, punch yourself
no,
in the crotch.
No, I know exactly where
that was
it
to the
came.
Listeners.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's, I mean, I sometimes think that what Reznor does is try and force emotion on you. It's kind of like, Come on, feel this. Come on. It hurts, doesn't it?
I don't think he's trying to force it. I think he's feeling it, so he's writing it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's just the overwrought rock vocals that make me feel like it's forced.
Yeah, he has got quite a melodramatic delivery at
some
places.
Yeah.
And then some of the other stuff where he gets kind of more synth pop, and it starts feeling a bit in excess for me.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, we've not done one of these since an early episode. Get out.
Yeah, you can say get out, but guess who's got the tickets to tonight's gig we're all going to?
Okay, fair enough.
That's definitely the... that's going to be the downwards... Not pre-downward spiral here. Pretty Hate Machine is pretty damn synth-pop. It's unavoidable.
But then, I mean, you're talking about his melodramatic delivery, so...
No, you're talking
about...
All right,
about, I'm yes, talking about... But then, The Great Destroyer and This Isn't the Place. I like them. I like it when he stops screaming and uses his inside voice.
Mm-hmm. Great Destroyer's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly when it goes all glitchy and fucked up at the end.
Yeah.
It's...
I like the industrial music. I think it's just his vocals.
See, I thought you would dig Pretty Hate Machine... with the fact that you are an ex-goth.
Yeah, it's very...
I never did the industrial goth side. I mean, when you said, like, Marilyn Manson, I'm like, no, never. Because I don't...
But it's before that.
Yeah, it was 89, you know, that was
There's
it.
Not really massive guitars on Pretty Hate Machine.
No, they're thin and...
Well, no, I mean Trent Reznor is... he's a massive Gary Numan fan.
Yeah.
And he claimed to have listened to Newman's second album... Telecon every day during the making of Pretty Hate Machine, actually.
Yeah. Well, that Pretty Hate Machine, it's... we've talked about Stadium Goth before when we were talking about Depeche Mode.
Yeah, yeah.
There were 10 months where the three most important albums of Stadium Goth were released.
Yeah.
Disintegration by The Cure came out in May 1989.
Mm-hmm.
In October 1989, Pretty Hate Machine came out, which was Nine Inch Nails' first album. And then Violated by Depeche Mode came out in March 1990. So Pretty Hate Machine is directly in the middle of both of those. And see, for my version of goth, those are the three most important. You know, when I used to think of myself as a goth, that was our big thing. I suppose because you were a goth before that.
Yeah.
That might well be, you know, you were more...
Hippie goth, if you like. The Mission and...
Yeah.
And glam goth like Gene Loves Jezebel.
Yeah.
Not an industrial side. You know, and then the sort of like atmospheric kind of Bauhaus and...
Yeah. But he's definitely taken influence from that kind of thing.
Yeah, and he's worked with Pete Murphy.
Yes, he has. Yeah.
And TV on the radio at the same time.
When I first heard Nine Inch Nails, the first track I heard was Happiness in Slavery, the live version.
From Woodstock. God damn it. How did you get into them from that?
I didn't.
Because that was the first one I heard as
it
well.
It was
like,
really, really...
Fuck, this is horrible.
Yeah.
They're all covered in mud. Everything's breaking.
Well, I didn't know they were covered in mud because it was the CD that I had. It was the first CD I ever bought. I bought it on a school German exchange in 1995 in Germany. And it was... I was like, I've heard about Nine Inch Nails, I'll check this bit out. Holy shit, what the fuck is... It's just really, really harsh, percussive, industrial...
But Happiness in Slavery is just a fucking brutal
relentless song.
It's so brutal, and the video is, like, horrifying.
Yeah, so I...
Well, it's banned.
So. Yeah, yeah, that's from the Broken movie.
Yeah.
Which was... people thought it was a snuff film, didn't they?
Yeah.
For a while.
Really?
Yeah. Basically, they made a film to go with it, which features a performance artist bloke climbing onto, like, this weird chair.
That's
a weird dentist
the
chair.
Happiness in Slavery video. Yeah, he just gets taken
and then
apart by machinery.
Basically gets ground up by drills and machines.
It's fucking horrible to watch.
Yeah.
But, like, the rest of the videos around that, the video for Pinions, like, follows a... pipe down from a toilet, isn't it?
Yes,
like
it
that.
Is.
And it
into,
follows down
into somebody in a gimp suit.
Yeah.
The Broken EP is kind of fucked up. The Broken movie is kind of fucked up, and that's why it's banned. But it was on the Closure video.
Yes, it was. The video to fucking hell. That one that That one that Skinny Puppy think is a rip-off of Dig It.
Is it Gave Up?
No, off Pretty Hate Machine.
Oh,
Down In It.
Down In It.
The video to that's banned as well, because they thought that was a snuff movie.
I don't think I've seen it.
Because he's getting chased up a multi-story car park, and then he jumps off at the end.
Right, yeah.
But everyone thought that was, because it's all shaky cam,
yeah.
Pre-Blair Witch, and everyone thought that was, it's like, no, but that's Trent. And there he is. It's obviously not a snuff movie, because he's not dead.
As a result of listening to that, didn't get into them for another few years, and I got into Marilyn Manson first. It was like Marilyn Manson was like a gateway drug to Nine Inch Nails.
At least you went in the right direction.
Exactly, and then from Nine Inch Nails, that got me into Joy Division because of their cover of Dead Souls on the Crow soundtrack.
Oh. I've actually got a couple of Marilyn Manson albums. Remembered.
Seriously, Antichrist Superstar,
yeah.
Mechanical Animals.
Antichrist Superstar's great, but that's because it's mostly Reznor produced, so it is a Nine Inch Nails album and with different vocals.
Mechanical Animals is brilliant as well.
Yeah.
I mean, but the thing about the really industrial Nine Inch Nails stuff, I think it would probably sound amazing in a nightclub in a warehouse somewhere, but when I was listening to this for the podcast, sat in my spare room with a glass of red wine, it doesn't really conjure up what you need. I should have gone to a nightclub in a warehouse.
Should have been with hesitation marks onwards, I think, at that point.
Yeah. It may also be another frame of reference thing, because me and Ian were listening to this in our sort of mid to late teens.
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot like the more industrial, the darker side of Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I'd got my cut-off points with Depeche Mode around about 1985.
Yeah.
So, frames of reference.
So, yeah.
But I mean, what is it with the With Teeth album you were saying earlier?
With the Teeth?
That's it's just how he pronounces With Teeth when he sings
on the
it.
Title,
oh, okay, right.
With the Teeth!
Like Marquee Smith or something.
Yes, it's very Marquee Smith.
See, that's the thing, right? You may not have picked up this with the Reznorian delivery. I did, and I can't stop hearing it now. He will always pronounce a T. Always.
Okay.
If you listen to the end of March of the Pigs, where it fades off beautifully and he goes, and everything's all right.
Yeah.
Like, you can barely hear it, but it's like, you fucker.
That's quite a Scottish thing, though. I like that in when I listen to King Creosote, that he will always pronounce the T.
Don't you bring that shit into the room.
I've got to. You get the T's at the end of things, very precise T's, and you get hard G's at the sound of things, and I like that. So that wouldn't stand out as something that would annoy me in
Reznor.
It's
just an oddness in his delivery, like Matt Bellamy's.
I read
him and Willie Wellow. Well, him both do that.
I mean, as so often with bands that I don't know very much about for this, I go off and read some reviews, just for shits and giggles, whatever. But I read a review on White Teeth.
A review on With Teeth because it's not very.
That's a Zadie
good.
Smith novel.
Yeah,
sorry.
That's not his best album. I like it, but it's not his best.
It just happened to be the one
better
I found.
Than a lot of other people's discographies, but it's not his best.
Ghosts 1-4 is better than a lot of people's discographies, but I still don't like it very much.
Well, it said. And maybe you can expand on this. It said, Trent makes a swipe for all that MTV gold, fails miserably, gets his ass kicked by all the other losers on the playground.
Okay, Only and Hand That Feeds are...
It's shameless. Singles.
Very, very,
but the
very
thing
pop.
Is, he's always done pop singles.
Exactly.
So it's not like... That review implies that he's selling out to get popular, which is not true.
No, it's what part of what he does.
If you know anything about Nine Inch Nails, like Head Like a Hole, his first ever single... Poppy.
I remember
Shit
that
Down
one.
And it was the first single.
Yes, it was.
Head Like a Hole, poppy as fuck, though.
Yeah.
It's catchy, there's a hook. That's what he's a good songwriter.
Yeah.
You can't say the fucker's selling out.
Well, what made me laugh about what made me laugh about this review is there was an edit afterwards, an edit of some months or possibly years later, that said, this is the best review I have ever written. Why the fuck do you guys not heart it?
Okay, says it all.
Because he's wrong.
Yeah, because he hasn't listened to the rest. If he's like, this is not the best Nine Inch Nails album, it's a bit average. that's an acceptable one. But saying this is a sellout when he's been writing songs like that since the start of the band is ridiculous.
Did you, in your finding reviews thing and trying to find critical reviews, did you find the infamous Pitchfork review of The Fragile?
No.
Okay, I'm sure it was Pitchfork. They reviewed The Fragile, and basically there's one guy that listened to it once in his car.
Right.
And admitted that in the review and says, I don't really get it, and just
it's
complete,
a fucking double album.
Exactly. It's a really dense double album, and he completely slags it off. And it just keeps getting brought up on the internet every now and again about
it's such a masterpiece, that album. Yeah. Because there's like recurring themes throughout it. That's a big Reznor thing.
Exactly.
Leitmotifs.
Downward Spiral's got it. Downward Spiral's got the one.
Yes.
But The Fragile's got three, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. They're just little melodies that come in and out of different songs every now and again.
I do love a leitmotif.
Yeah. I always thought it was leitmotif. But it's me pronouncing things, so carry on with leitmotif.
I actually lean towards leitmotif.
Yeah, that's
but right. But it's spelt L-E-I?
I thought it was L-I-E.
I have no idea.
But anyway.
We know what you mean.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
It's like, I don't know, I like the fact that he weaves melodies in that link the album together as a journey, so you can listen to stuff for singles, but then you put it on and you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
It was all there.
The only album that I've ever really not loved was Ghosts 1 to 4. And it was... I never got into it. It just sounded like it was unfinished. Because it's all instrumental and a lot of it is...
It is just snippets.
Snippets and sketches and stuff of stuff he's been doing in the studio. But I think... I re-listened to it recently.
Yeah.
And I think what I'd been doing wrong is I'd been thinking of it in the context of a Nine Inch Nails album.
Yeah, that's it. I've never done that.
Judging it on the same thing as The Fragile and Downward Spiral. Whereas if you think of it like a Brian Eno, like his ambient
albums. It's Reznor going, I like this idea of doing soundtracks. I wonder what I can do.
Yes, because before he started doing the Social Network. And
what Reznor does, you said about the releasing stuff on torrent, that's a very Brian Eno thing, actually, because he does that with his... What was his record label called? Eno's, that is. Digital Global...
I don't know the name of his label.
Well, he puts out... He does sound recording, so does a recording from the sound desk of every gig he does, and then just puts them up for sale on his website afterwards to just sell direct to the fans, and so it's the DIY thing again.
Yeah. Did you watch any live Nine Inch Nails videos?
No.
Ah, well.
No. That live, they are definitely worth. Next time they tour, you should come with us.
It's a fucking spectacle. It's great.
He's the lights and everything are normally absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like last time they got big screens behind them, and they were, they must have been using something like the fucking Kinect from Xbox and stuff like that, because they, as he moved, like ripples on the screen would move behind him and stuff like that. It was the production values.
Yeah. Well, even in the early days when they got no budget, they used to completely rip off Fields of the Nephilim, Behave Yourself with
Downward Spiral Tour, yeah.
They were just covered in flour.
Corn flour.
So we are doing Fields of the Nephilim in hen then.
Yes.
There was all little bits of drape hung up and stuff
I accidentally replicated that at work the other day, wearing a black shirt, eating jelly babies that are covered in icing sugar. I look like I was in early Nine Inch Nails.
Excellent.
Have you ever seen the video closure?
Yes.
The live footage on that is fucking hilarious in places.
Yeah.
Because that was when they still broke shit.
Well, he's carried on breaking stuff occasionally since then. Did you go to the Birmingham Academy show just after the Reading one a few years ago, where he hadn't got the light show because it wouldn't fit in the venue?
Yes, I think so.
Because he was definitely breaking equipment on that, because he was
in a bad mood. Yeah,
he was. I saw them twice in about 3 days, because I saw them at Reading, where they got the full live show screens, which is where when they did the Great Destroyer on that tour, they'd got they were like light curtain type things that moved. Sometimes they were in front of them, sometimes they were behind them. And when they did The Great Destroyer, where the music basically all glitches and just goes amazing and sounds like Aphex Twin. The visuals sort of matched all that, and it was all like glitching all over the thing, and it looked like you were watching a TV that wasn't properly tuned in, but live.
We're going to circle back round to Year Zero in a second. I just want to...
Yeah.
But a video of them doing Down in It, and Reznor has broken his own... Because he's got a keyboard attached to the drum riser on like a pneumatic strut. He's broken that. He has circled around behind the keyboard player, yanked his mic stand, which has taken his entire keyboard rig out.
Shit.
Kicked the bass player into the crowd, who was leaning over doing backing vocals, right?
I've seen it.
Bounced off the drum riser and fallen directly behind Robin Fink, the guitarist, who has looked around and gone, fuck me, I've escaped this, taken a step back, tripped over Reznor, and fallen over. Like, I think the drummer was the only person that was intact after that.
It's sounding more and more like a fall gig.
Yeah.
Like, it was an astonishing moment of utter destruction.
But
And that's why you didn't get into Happiness in Slavery, because that was the same tour.
Yes. But the... So he got all these elaborate screens and stuff that they'd worked on loads. Yeah. And then they played at Birmingham Academy in the old Academy, which is a great venue.
But not...
The Hummingbird.
Yeah. Used to be the Hummingbird. It wasn't big enough for them to fit his screens in, and he hadn't realised until they got there. So it was almost like a Spinal Tap moment.
I imagine his tour agent will have got some shit.
It meant that we got a really, really aggressive set with him being really... He started the set, he came on, and he explained it, and he said, look, I'm really fucking pissed off because I wanted you to see all these, like, this light show that we've worked really hard on, and we've not been able to do it. So I'm fucking angry, but we're going to play for you anyway. And later on, you could tell he was starting to really enjoy it, because it was almost like going back to their earlier gigs before they'd got all that. But there were definitely at least a couple of occasions where keyboard stands got kicked over during that gig, because there's a quote that he said something like, where if your equipment malfunctions on stage, it's insulting you, it must be destroyed. So, but yeah, I've seen the first time I tried to see Nine Inch Nails, they didn't show up. It was
That's when the drummer got really, really bad.
Yes, diarrhea.
Stomach flu. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they were. It was the Lost Weekend Festival.
Yeah, because I really wanted to go to that and I didn't, but I did go to Glastonbury and I saw them because they survived that one.
Yeah, so we went to, it was London Docklands Arena. We travelled down, first time I'd ever been to a gig in London, and we'd driven down really excited. On the tube, we start hearing rumours that Nine Inch Nails have cancelled. We're like, what? Because this was pre-internet.
Yeah.
Well, it existed, but nobody had it on their phones. In fact, not everybody had phones.
Yeah.
Back then. So we get closer and closer to the venue, and we're hearing more and more about it. And when we get there, there's signs up saying, Nine Inch Nails have had to pull out due to the drummer's illness. The other bands of the day, which included A Perfect Circle, Queen Adrena, Earth Tone 9, are all still playing, so you can either get a refund and not come in, or you can come in and enjoy the show. And we were like,
what did you do?
Perfect Circle, it's their first UK gig.
I saw them at Glastonbury as well.
Yeah. We've got to go and see Perfect Circle. We've come all this way. We'll go in. So we went in. And Nine Inch Nails had still got all their T-shirts on the merchandise store. And one of the T-shirts that they were selling had a lyric from the first track on The Fragile, because it was The Fragile Tour.
Where the fuck were you?
Perfect.
Which our friend Lisa bought.
So Clint Mansell from Pop Will Eat Itself does backing vocals on that
Trent
album.
Trent Reznor's best friend.
Yeah.
Because
Pop Will Eat Itself were signed to Nothing Records, weren't they, later on?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, because Mansell's used Nine Inch Nails music in his film scores that does now, sort of after PWAI split. Because what was the...
They've
at the top of this show, you said that Nine Inch Nails is award-winning, Oscar-nominated...
Oscar-winning.
Oscar-winning. So, what film?
Social Network.
Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Right.
There's Vietnam a documentary. Well. There's a Vietnam documentary. There's also... I really should know the name of this, but there's a soundtrack that they've put out recently that is a collaboration between Clint Mansell, Nine Inch Nails, and Mogwai.
Ooh.
But what's, because there's the film Requiem for a Dream.
That's Clint Mansell.
He credited Reznor as the musical consultant on that.
Right, yeah, yeah.
When Reznor was living in New Orleans, I think Mansell lived with him. And there were
incidentally,
nothing studios there.
If any of you have not seen Requiem for a Dream, don't. It is the most depressing film you will ever see in your fucking life. It's probably about getting on for 20 years since I've last seen it, and I'm still depressed from it.
Apparently, it's on my list of films that I have to watch. So
it's excellent. It's an amazingly well-made film. It doesn't turn out well for any of the characters.
Not a surprise. Not a surprise.
But
Year Zero, man. Year Zero, right? This is how, like, you know, people do concept albums. This trumps all of the concept albums.
Okay.
Yes.
Because, like, what, about 6 months previous to that, they released a shirt. The shirt had capitalized letters, seemingly at random, which was a website. Then they would release, like, hide memory sticks in venues that they were playing with unreleased tracks.
People would find, like, a little little USB thumb drive in the toilet or something, not in the actual toilet.
Yeah, like, it would be stuck to the security barrier or in the toilet or places like that. And it's got, you know, unreleased tracks on weird image. Like, they were using those spectrogram images, weren't they? So it's a sound, and you're like, the fuck is that?
But
and
you put it through a spectral analyzer.
And it comes up with an image. And then the Year Zero CD itself went in black, came out white with binary on it, and you could translate that and go to a website, and there's a whole background plot.
But before the CD actually came out, there were... I can't remember exactly how they did it, but there were, like, coordinates for locations and
times. The phone things, yeah. Yeah, they gave people boxes.
Yeah.
And there was
so
a
people turned up to a location, were given a box.
Is this...
Which had got a... there was a mobile phone in there.
Yeah, and some other stuff.
And this phone then gave them further instructions, and they basically then had to go to this certain location where they were, like... Were they, like, bundled into a van or something?
Yeah, bundled into a black van with blacked-out windows, driven to another location.
Did you
where
take
Nine Inch Nails then did a gig.
Yeah.
Did you take influence from some of these things when you did your album?
100%.
Yeah,
because it's fucking great.
Your first day as part of Our World.
No,
not even from that one, really. Because that one, well, you did when you did the launch, and that was like, turn up at this strange, deserted hall. And
That was less influenced by it.
The first,
that's what it was making me think of.
The first launch, we actually did get people to turn up at the assembly rooms, only invited people, and then we put them on a coach and sent them into the middle of nowhere.
I didn't know you then, so I didn't get invited.
We were ushered onto a coach by people in suits and motorcycle helmets.
But you did that.
And
but
I
you did that
gig.
For.
I was at the thing, and then we loaded them on, and then I got into my car, raced past the coach, and got to the gig. So everyone was like, "Where the fuck are we going?" Ian was there.
Yeah.
And, like, John, our drummer, was one of the people in the helmet which people didn't...
But didn't you do a similar thing with the ushering people in for your first day as well?
Which
I was invited
attendance.
To. And
for anybody that doesn't know, Ian's in a band called Structures. You should check them out. They're very good.
Not the Canadian fuckers.
No. Proper Structures. Structures band.
I was invited to that one, but I couldn't go.
I
regret it to this day.
We refer to them as the enforcers. But yes. We went from crash helmets that we borrowed from the place that we did the venue at, because it was, Mike's wedding venue?
Yeah.
That was it.
Yes.
They just redid the whole thing, and now it's like a $10,000 to book it wedding venue rather than a knackered
an old
Victorian
barn.
Yeah. And it was like Helmets for the Quad Biking Adventures. We're just like, oh, steal all the black ones, cool. But yeah, we've got proper riot helmets now because, you know.
Excellent.
We upgrade.
So, yeah, amazing live band, amazing. I mean, he's absolute genius.
Yeah,
in the
and
studio.
Like massive conceptual things. Like,
well,
there's just so much thought.
For the most recent EP, so there was sort of. They released Hesitation Marks a couple of years ago, full-length album. That was fairly conventional. Then...
But, oh, God, no. But it's such a weird album, that, though, isn't it? Because
it's
really lovely, chilled-out electronica until everything, the song. And
which
it's
is
the only major key thing they've ever written. And you're like, what just happened?
it's a really happy, like, almost pop-punk song, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I love it. It's great.
It is. It's amazing. But it just... catches you like, every single time I've listened to it. It's caught me off guard. Like, I know it's there, but the rest of it's quite meandering and
gives?
Ambient.
Well, there's a couple of tracks on there that sound very sort of electro goth industrial sort of thing that remind me. They still sound modern, but they remind me of sort of pretty Hate Machine kind of sound. But then so just before Christmas last year, they suddenly put out an announcement that there was a new EP available. They were doing reissues of all the albums on vinyl.
Yeah,
and
this
were,
was when we were having our Structures Christmas drinks.
It was
bizarrely,
when I,
considering the non-mutual bromance between me and Brent
Reznor. I was on my work Christmas party.
Oh, yeah, because I ran into you afterwards, didn't
yes.
I?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was on my work.
No,
no, you
I didn't.
I ran into
people from your work afterwards.
Yes, you met people I work with, but not me, but Lindsay, who you do know.
Yeah.
But yeah, me and my friend Chess, who I work with, were both sitting there at the table with everybody else just doing normal Christmas party chatting, and we were both sitting there going, should we order the Fragile? And I ended up ordering Fragile Deviations, which is an expanded... instrumental version of the Fragile that was only ever being released on vinyl. So I was like, I fucking gotta buy that. It's £80, but I've gotta buy it. And they also released a new EP where you could buy it on vinyl
and
or
physical object.
A physical object.
Oh no, physical component.
Physical component.
Physical.
Physical component.
Yeah.
Which it didn't tell you what it was, but it just told you that
I've got it and I still don't know what it is.
It would arrive and you would have to deal with it. And what it turned out to be when it finally arrived later, because there were loads of delays.
Yeah, I got mine pretty soon, but...
Mine still hasn't arrived and it's nearly a fucking year ago.
Yeah, that's
sort it out,
shit.
Null Corporation, you fuckers. I'll send you another email tomorrow. Anyway, what it turned out when it did arrive... if it did arrive, was it's basically an envelope with a warning label on it. And if you open up the envelope, it's got art cards in there.
Yeah, and there's some transparencies and stuff as well, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But it's all covered in a black powder, which is sort of basically like photocopier toner.
It's definitely not going to be toner, because toner's carcinogenic.
Yeah, yeah.
So
there's
it'll
no
be,
way they could put that
it's
in.
It's non-toxic, but it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can't open it. I mean, I don't want to open it, because I like it.
Yeah.
Like that, and I don't want to ruin it. And also, I would be single, I imagine, if I opened it in the flat. It's going to make a mess.
The next EP,
Ad Violence,
the physical component for that turned out to be, it's like a sort of schematic for a machine.
Yeah, which is from the front cover of the...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting, though.
But it's a great EP, particularly the second one. And there's, by the time this goes out, there may well have been another one. We're recording this in October. But allegedly there was going to be three EPs within a year. So hopefully there's another one, but we've not heard it yet. But yeah, we'd probably better start wrapping that up now.
Yeah, I figure.
Because, that's a long one. So...
Because we're going to a gig tonight and we're running out of time.
This is true. So next time it's going to be the letter O. So we'll be talking about ocean size and Okay. Ozzy Osbourne.
Orange Goblin.
Not Orange Goblin.
Orange Juice.
But there's a fairly good chance that Ozzy Osbourne, we
Agent
may be
Orange.
Bending some rules there and discussing another band Maybe. That Ozzy Osbourne has been a member of. So,
Coal Chamber.
I don't think... No, he was on
Shut
the front
the
cover...
Bunker.
He was on the front cover of that of their first album, which I only realised recently.
Yeah. Thanks to That Awful Sound, by any chance.
Yes, it was.
Shout out. In the video as well.
Shout out to That Awful Sound podcast. Excellent podcast. Yeah, so we've been with Dig Music. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.